This episode of Dismissed is featuring my special guest, Jedediah Collins. Jedediah is a certified financial planner and also a former NFL football player who has a really unique perspective on money. And he is really, really passionate about how to teach others on how to use money. So I think this will be a really fun one for you. We are going to talk about financial literacy. We're going to talk about the financial realities for professional athletes, as well as jump into some football talk. Jedediah was a former fullback. We'll talk about the fullback position, and we'll do some Super Bowl predictions. So it's going to be a wide-ranging one for you today. I hope you enjoy it. I really enjoyed speaking with Jed, and here we go. Hello and welcome to Disrupted TV presents Dismissed, a podcast about expat life, entrepreneurship, and education. As always, I am your host, Jeremy Williams, at JWilliamsEDU in the Twitterverse, joined by a very, very special guest for a number of reasons. I'm joined today by Jedediah Collins, CFP. He is the Director of Financial Education at Brighton Jones, and he's got, you know, a really unique perspective on financial education, which obviously is something that I'm deeply passionate about. So I'm super excited to welcome Jed Collins to the show today. Jed, welcome to Dismissed.
Hey, I appreciate it. I'm humbled and honored to be a part of your message. And just truly, I love kind of our day and age and getting to meet and introduce myself to people like you and being able to then go back and kind of see the message you're on. So I definitely can understand how this collaboration is going to be pretty neat.
Yeah, I'm really excited. And we connected through a post that I had put on LinkedIn relating to Adrian Peterson. And before we jump into that, and you wrote a really good article about that too, why don't we start with how you became interested in finances and financial education as a passion of yours? How did that take place for you?
Perfect. So I was a rookie in the NFL, and I was handed my first game check. And in the NFL, you take your contract, you divide it by 17, and you get pretty sizable game checks. And if you can kind of start to think about some of those higher paid guys, yeah, they get checks that big when you start to make $10+ million a season. But I was never one of those guys. But my paycheck was a sizable amount, and I received it. And my fear was I had spent that money before I even opened the envelope. I knew where this check was going, and the girl sitting next to me, who was my girlfriend about to become my fiance, knew exactly where the money was going too. We bought an engagement ring. We were super excited. Good news, flash forward. We just celebrated 10 years, so it ended up being a good investment. But I tell my wife to this day, it was a poor financial decision. Why? Because my first paycheck, I was a spender. I received money. I spent money. I had a day-to-day relationship with it. And so that scared me enough and woke me up enough to the reality that if I wanted to walk out of the NFL locker room with, quote-unquote, the dream truly being captured, I was going to have to begin to empower myself and educate myself around how wealthy people handle their money. Wealthy people are not spenders. They're not even savers. They become investors. And that was how I began my journey, was a failed attempt at personal finances, spending my first check, and then waking up to the reality of, you know, the statistics, the documentaries, the sad stories that are going around about professional athletes, and saying, if I'm never going to be the high paid guy, I have to be the highly educated guy. And I spent all my off seasons studying for and getting certified in financial planning.
Well, that's a really different perspective on money. And it's one that I think, you know, for someone who listens at just a ear glance or just kind of listens to a little bit of what you're saying, maybe they go, oh, okay, NFL player, you know, game check. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, like, what does that have to do with me? I'm, you know, $32,000 a year as a teacher. So how do you take that message and translate it to the everyday person to make sure that they don't just shrug it off and go, oh, okay, you know, NFL football player wants to invest some money?
I fully appreciate that mindset, and truly it's been a series of kind of light bulbs going off. So I began, hey, yeah, big dumb jocks in the NFL. We get big checks. We spend big checks. Nobody's really awed by that story. But as I was receiving these, I looked at myself and I said, listen, I was grew up in Orange County around a lot of money. I was a business degree. I studied accounting. So I knew money, but nobody had sat me down and said, you know, you're the Johnson family. You do make $32,000 a year. Here's where it's going to go. Here's how to spend it. Here's how to protect it. And here's how to make it go to work for you. And so I turned to my brothers, who are much more highly educated than me. One got a master's in engineering at Berkeley. Another got a Harvard law degree. And I asked them. And so that's when my real light bulb started going off, was when the academic system, not just to student athletes, but to all students, was failing because they had no answer. They didn't have any idea what I should do with these checks or what I should be going to get or how to protect myself. And then as I began down that journey, I said, okay, I want to go and I want to teach college students. I saw the void in our education system, and I wanted to fill that void with personal finance basics. And that was an eye-opening experience, because then I did realize, hey, the $40,000 salary, the $80,000 salary, the $150,000 salary, whatever number is coming in, the problems exist in the exact same spectrum. Sure, your immediacy is maybe different depending on how much income you have, but truly, I know more $200,000 incomes who are broke and in debt than I do $60,000 incomes. And why that is because of that fundamental flaw of understanding money. Understanding how to use money, strategizing money, and more importantly, being efficient with your money. So to the person who has $32,000, just started a teaching degree, I think you have the most potential and the most upside, because you miss small, you aim small, you miss small. When you have more room to kind of make mistakes and miss opportunities, you then don't feel so bad about it. When you are at a $32,000 income, you say to yourself, I know exactly where I want to go with these dollars, why I'm earning them, and here is my plan moving forward. And you can build those efficiencies into any sizable amount of money.
That's a great point. And I think that part of the interesting situation for me is that I began and spent most of my career in Northwest Indiana, in the Gary, Indiana area, and was a teacher, vice principal, all the way up to a superintendent. And so much of the conversation in Gary was, we got to get these kids to college, because if they just go to college, they're going to be fine. And when you have that mindset, what you sacrifice is any conversation around how money works at all, because the message is college or die. You'll break the cycle of poverty from going to college. And what we've learned in not just urban America, suburban America, rural America, is that college is not a silver bullet to guarantee a better life. In fact, in many instances, it can bury you financially. And the value proposition of going to college, depending on where you want to live and how much you want to make, can put you in a really bad financial position. So where do you think like schools need to go in sort of reframing how money works and how we think about money? Because really, there's no mandated curriculum or understanding. Econ class in a high school is not how to understand how money works. Let's be serious. It's a joke.
Yeah.
You know? And so kids are leaving, making the most important first adult decision with, you know, depending on their parents, very limited understanding of how money works. So how do we tackle this?
So I love what you're saying. And I love that idea of we leaned on college as the excuse. College was the way out of poverty. And that's not proving to be the reason. I'm going to circle back to why here in a second. But I would even say our second failure is looking at money as the reason, as the way out of poverty. Money is a important piece of the equation, but money is not the noun. Money is not the objective. Money is a verb and the vehicle that is going to take us out of poverty. It is not the destination. And I think that shift in our mindset is very important and valuable, because of our kind of downfall in society is not understanding why we're headed in directions, why we want to go and capture a college education and get more income and get more money. is because of a reason, and that reason is different for each and every one of us, but understanding that beginning and beginning with that end in mind is vital in your success around finances and your success around your career and success around your family or really any aspect. So I look at college and I see the failure on the individual side, the student side, as not really comprehending what they want out of their college degree, not setting a destination. And it doesn't have to be a finite destination. It could just be a direction, but not really having an actionable purpose towards their college degree and their college education. And I think that is beginning to see why we're failing is we're accruing the debt without a purpose or a goal. And that does not equate the risk to the return. How I would see schools beginning to capture it from a student debt perspective, we do have to understand and limit the increase in college tuition because it is getting, you know, too much for what the return is today. But how I see schools identifying personal finance is through engaging education. And that's what I would consider myself today as an engaging educator. You've been in education all your life. You realize the importance of standing in front of a room and wearing that hat of entertainer, wearing that hat of engager, and then wearing that hat of educator. And you have to be able to dial in all three if you truly want to make an impact on the students or the listeners' life. And how we need to do that in high schools and colleges and even at companies as young professionals start out is giving people more personalized content information. How can I make the subject matter personalized to your situation and then give you a direction of what to go do with this new information? Where financial education has failed in the past is we produce good content, we translate even some good concepts, but we don't tell students what to go do with it. And that's where, my company, Brighton Jones, and I just wrote a book called Teach Me Money, where it's the first 10 questions of your financial journey. And each chapter, we really wanted to end with an actionable item that says, you just learned about this subject, this question, now go do this. And at the end of the book, we're hoping that you have achieved, if not all 10 steps, maybe 2, 3, 4 of those steps. And even having taken one of them, the book was worthwhile because it made personal finances real and actionable.
It's no different than your physical health, right? If you're not the weight you want or, and you make a positive change with either with exercise or diet, it's better than not doing either of them. So one step in the right direction is still a step in the right direction. I want to keep it there because we did become connected through JT McCormick, who I don't want to use the word worship, but he just absolutely been an inspiration in my life. I had him on the podcast. And one of the things he was talking about his tribe at Scribe was that the financial aspect and their financial well-being, not just their salary, their intake, but like helping them understand finances and figure that out was part of their well-being package and what they do for organizational culture. So I really like that you mention it's not just about the K-12 and college. It should extend further than that.
Absolutely. And to tag on to your idea of your personal health and really being actionable about it, I'm one of my favorite quotes I tell people all the time, especially as I promote writing more and more. I tell people all the time, you want to become a better speaker, write. You want to be a better communicator or interesting, just start writing to yourself. And my biggest kind of advice is it's better to write than to try to write well. And finances, your health, all the same mindset, all the same principles. It's better to do something than to try to do it perfectly. So just getting started, you'll learn 1,000 times more about any subject. But yes, JT McCormick, I'll echo what your praises are for him. He is an amazing story. And more than that, he's an amazing communicator. And what I've been able to track and pick up on is he's a great leader. And where I realized, so my mission and my passion came out around high school and college students. I saw the void, I saw the educational gap, and I said, this is an audience and a niche I want to address. And I've kind of towed the line and went straight forward at them saying, I want to get you as you begin your journey, and I want to be able to build you to where you need to get to as an adult. And as I did that, people the last 2, 3, 4 years have continued to tell me, well, where's the business in that? How are you going to charge these young people money? Yada, yada, yada. And I kept saying, hey, it's a good thing. We need it. Why don't I just continue to pursue it? And the light bulb finally went off around corporations and companies. When through either through our 401k offering or just financial education as its standalone one-off item, companies started to ask me and my company to come in and present these financial education courses. And that's when I started to see the ability to say, hey, this is not just going to be a neat purpose. This is also going to escalate into a business. And when I can create a business around it, then it's sustainable. And then I can go help more people. And I'm proud to say now we have curriculum and content that I go into companies, whether you're getting your first paycheck as a 22 or 3-year-old, whether you're looking at 35 buying a first house or having a first kid, or 55, I'm starting to target retirement. You know, we have 20 different classes that turn the tables and become more workshops around the individual. And you are able to, let's say I'm preparing for retirement, I walk you through a mindset of creating your own net worth statement, because that is a high level understanding of if you are prepared for freedom. And so as I see the opportunity begin to build, it's because people like JT McCormick or corporations and companies today start to see the impact of financial wellness on the individual employee and colleague, and that importance is rising. And I'm fortunate that this just happens to be kind of the direction I was headed, and it's a passion and an interest of mine. But I think you'll see over these next probably 5 years a shift in your work environment from, hey, they just offered me to a 401k match, to they sit me down, they explain what that 401k match is, and they also make sure the rest of my plan is built out. That's how they know I'll be financially free one day and truly not liable on them.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I think that you've already touched on this in the front end of our episode today, but like what I'm facing in the K-12 sector is that in Gary, it was college or die. And here in the Middle East, in Abu Dhabi, it's, I want to be a doctor or engineer. And then when you dig deeper into why, the why is because they need to make a lot of money to be happy. And so what we're trying to do as a school is say, well, what is the purpose and passion that you're deeply committed to that gives you, that wakes you up in the morning, gives you a sense of joy? Okay, it's not that you need to make a lot of money to pursue that. What you need to be able to do is have a financial plan and understand how money works so that you could make $45,000, $50,000 and put the money to good use and be able to pursue something that gets you up and excited every day. But that mindset of, I need to earn more, is really tough. I think I'm assuming just for, not just for students, but also for adults. So how do we start to, is it just simply education? Like what's the way that we invert that mindset to how much you keep and invest and use to how much you earn?
So I gear it back to what I call the money exchange. And it's no longer putting a priority on what's coming in. It's not even putting a priority on what's going out. It's just simply recognizing the exchange and the medium that money exemplifies. And it has a little bit of a meditative quality to where it's, you know, kind of like sitting and not being in your thoughts, but just identifying your thoughts. It's kind of doing that with your relationship with money. If I know how much I have coming in, I know where the money is going, and I know ultimately what I want to get to, which is the financial plan you're referencing, I can then begin to make choices and decisions and exchanges for how to get there. I know I'm willing to maybe not buy a drink at dinner tonight for 2 or 3 nights because I want to go to a movie this weekend. That's my exchange in opportunity. I know I'm willing to go to a public school as opposed to a private university because I want to go be an expert into this industry. I know that's my exchange. So I think it is an awareness. I do think education is where we have to begin because I use the acronym USE, use. If you don't understand money, you're never going to be able to build to level 2, which is the S of strategizing, or even get close to level 3, which is being efficient with your money. So yes, I think education is the first understanding element. But then I think we make it actionable and strategic and really show people, hey, for 70% of the world, maybe not the world, 70% of people interested in personal finances, they don't need an expert. They need someone to give them a good couple steps in each of the directions of personal finance. I love looking at money and personal finance as a wheel and having a lot of spokes in that wheel. Is investments one of them? Absolutely. Is it an important one? Sure. But just as important is understanding what taxes and society bills you have to pay, understanding your debt, understanding your insurance plan. How do I transfer some of those risks? If I don't have the other pieces of that wheel built out, my plan is going to eventually fail.
Or, Jed, understanding how moving abroad creates a different relationship with money, because maybe you have free public health care in the country you're living, mm-hmm. or maybe you don't pay income tax. All of these things, but what I hear you saying is it's like this metacognitive aspect of being thoughtful. Like, to your point, in the UAE, if I go to dinner, water is sold by the bottle. You can't just get like a glass of ice water with your meal complimentary. So if your view is, well, they, you know, I drink water, but you know, they don't have it here, so I'm going to buy a fresh fruit juice or a Pepsi, when you take that and then think about that decision over 5 years of living here, it's a lot of money. The Choose FI guys talk about this a lot too. They give the example of, you know, if you have a car and you buy a used older car that is dependable, what type of like money you will save over the course of 45 years if you can do that. And these simple decisions really make all the difference in the world. And I wonder how, do you have any stories of when you've talked to people and explained this to people, you use that understand part of the use acronym you're describing, and like the light bulb clicks for them. What is it typically that makes someone go, oh, I get it?
Truly one of the biggest misconceptions. Actually, let me touch on one thing that you said that I love is the understanding of a new car versus a 2 or 3 year older car is not the opportunity cost, which is the benefit that you're giving up, is not just, hey, I bought a new car, I'm going to have to spend $10,000 more. It's when I buy that 2 year old car, that $10,000 not is just a savings, but it becomes an employee. And if I'm looking at using money, that $10,000 savings over time can turn into $50,000, $100,000. And then that is the true opportunity cost that you're giving up. One of the biggest light bulbs that people have is, and as I talk to professional athletes, this is typically one of the first entry points that I have with them is, I don't ever want them to look at, hey, I'm a second or third year player, I need to go invest my money, I have money, let's go put it all to work. Because they don't know what their career is going to have. But the idea around, I have a little bit of money, why do I need it to go to work for me? Is because, number one, money is lazy. If you don't put it to work for you, it is not going to. And number two is, there is a monster out there that just eats up your dollars, which is called inflation. And inflation is one of the most misunderstood or even just untaught subjects that has a vital impact on all of our lives. And so one of the light bulbs that goes off is just showing simply how much purchasing power you will have in a savings account in 10, 20 years versus an investment account as it relates to your real return of taxes and inflation. Because if you're just getting 1 or even 2% sitting in a savings account, you're actually losing money. Your money is not worth, because of inflation, because the average cost of everything we buy, that bottle of water at dinner, that movie ticket, that car, what that house, whatever it is doing nothing but going up in value. And that's the idea of inflation. That is eating away at any dollars that are sitting just lazily on the couch, not working for you. And so one of the big light bulbs people have is they think, all I have to do is save. I have $1 million sitting in a savings account. Well, that $1 million each day, each month, each year is actually going down in what it can do for you if it's not working.
That's a great point. But let's transition to the Adrian Peterson story, because that is how we connected initially. JT tagged you in an article that I had, or not article, just a post I had penned. But to me, the salient point was, let's stop the conversation about how much people earn, because it doesn't matter. Like, what you earn is not the largest indicator of financial success or personal happiness. And it was interesting because it, to your point in your article, it made it to the, you know, why can't these damn athletes just save their money? They get so much money. So do you want to talk about some of the challenges that professional athletes face when it comes to finances and why it isn't so simple as just, you know, making an easy decision of saving your money?
And you're absolutely right. It's never simple. With more is always expected. And that's of yourself, of your teammates, of the family you never knew you had, of the friends around you. Look at lottery winners. It is definitely not money as the solution. One of my biggest pet peeves around professional athletes are the newspaper articles. But Bob Joe just signed a $100 million deal. Bob Joe did not sign a $100 million deal. Bob Joe gets $65 million and is fortunate and lucky to do so. But if he bases his personal financial plan off the newspaper article, he's not only broke, he's $35 million in debt.
Oof, yeah, and so it makes a lot of sense.
It's that beginning of, well, number one, athletes and people really have no idea around the numbers that we're throwing out. Number two, it's this misconception of, now that the athlete has it, again, at 18, you make a major decision in your life around going to college. At 22, 21, if somebody were to have handed you $3 to $5 million, what kind of decisions do you think you'd be making with them?
Oh, God.
And that is part of the realization, is we keep pointing to the athlete as the problem, and the athlete changes every year and the problem pertains and still exists. I point to a bigger picture of an issue is, most of athletes, I was not really in this category because my father was an academic and he was a reader, and he persisted on me and my brothers reading as student athletes. But most athletes are handed the ball at age 10 and told, if you do this thing right, you don't have to worry about anything else. And I think that's one of the biggest mistakes we can make, because when that athlete does finally reach the pinnacle and walks across the draft day board as a $20 million, 22-year-old, they're not going to change. Why would they change? Everything has been come to fruition based on that financial plan of, do this one thing right and everything else takes care of itself, from 10 years old. So that is another reason why people look at athletes and say, why is it so hard? Well, it's because a lot of athletes, especially big named athletes, are never really introduced to reality until it's too late. And I see that as a big, big issue. The third one is, people always point to the frivolous spending, and in Adrian Peterson's case, as well as all other financially insoluble people, they do make some frivolous decisions and some poor financial decisions. But the reality
is, don't we all to our own earning, you know, like we buy some stupid pair of shoes, and relatively, if you take the percentage of, you know, your monthly salary and you probably equate it to a game check, it's probably the same amount.
And so that's what is why it's so hard, is every little mistake is magnified. The professional athlete has to treat each year that they're in the game as a decade in real life. And they have to spend and financially think that way. That concept, that mindset around being able to project 10, 20, 30 years into the future is extremely hard, especially for athletes, because we are such immediate sensory people. You miss a play, you get the next play to make up for it. You lose a game, you get another game to make up for it. In money, it doesn't really happen that way. And like you just said, if you equate a $10,000 mistake that a professional athlete makes to your $100 mistake around, hey, I, you know, switched my airline flight, whatever, it bought me a few hours, it's not a big deal. Those mistakes are magnified and then put into the public eye, which makes it even harder. But I think the third P piece to why it's not easy for an athlete to truly capture the dream is because of that 10X factor, that multiplication side of it, that at 22, 23, 24, any mistake you make around your plan or your finances or your money is going to be felt for years. And that is a really hard concept to get a young, ego-driven man or woman to really bite off and chew.
I'm a massive Chicago Bears fan, so we're going to get into some football. But an example of this would be, through the Bears drudgery that was the Mark Trestman era and the John Fox era, Cameron Meredith came on as this breakout wide receiver. He had two or three really, really great seasons and became a number one receiver in Chicago. He gets hurt last year. They go through the process of evaluating him. They decide not to re-sign him because his contract expired. He goes to the Saints. The Saints pick up an option on him. And then, he's never the same player. He just can't, from an injury perspective, get on the field. And so how do you talk to athletes when the shelf life is so unpredictable and, they could cut on a dime and rip their ACL or MCL and they're potentially cut if they're not someone with guaranteed money in their contract, because this is a huge issue in football particularly. So how do you get them to understand, how delicate all of this is?
So number one, very, very few guys are the guaranteed money guys. So I speak to the masses, not the minority, the 90% of guys who are more like me than the Drew Breeses. I look at the Drew Breeses, who is a phenomenal guy, phenomenal leader, but he's going to be fine. I don't think he needs my help necessarily. But that speaks to kind of two thoughts. Is number one, why I don't want players to go out and invest while they're playing is because they don't know where they're going to end their careers. They don't know if it's next month or next year or if they do have 6 to 10 more years to play. And so you try to be a little bit more conservative with it there, because the number one investment that they can make is in themselves and one more year in their career. You tell a rookie the best investment they can make is make the team next year, and it kind of opens their eyes to what investing really is. Let's say a $100,000 investment returns 10%, which is pretty solid.
Yeah.
That's only $10,000. So what does one more year in the league make, which you're going to be a $600,000 second year player? That's a big, big, significant difference. And so it's turning the focus to what you can control. When you talk about an injury taking you away, well, did you look into disability insurance? Was that a possibility? It is hard on rookie deals to get stuff like that structured, but well, maybe I was looking at my auto insurance and making sure that peace of mind part of my plan was taken care of, or an umbrella policy. Was I a draft pick? Do I need something like that? So I try to address the pieces to a plan that players do control. Taxes, obviously a big hit and a hard one, but there are items around your taxes, specifically itemized, that you do control. And people challenge me on that all the time. Well, you don't control if you pay taxes. There are enough situations where we see the reality is everybody controls how much taxes they pay. It's just how much do you understand the tax code and the systems available to you. And so lastly, it's just that idea around when I want to build a plan for a $32,000 teacher or a $300,000 rookie in Major League Baseball, it's no longer about the return aspect. It's the goals aspect. And I really want to make that subtle shift again to money being the vehicle, not the destination. Our goals aspect is, how many years are we protected from money? I don't want to be just rich. Rich is a good thing. Rich means in the moment I have money. In the moment I'm a $250,000 doctor. In the moment I'm rich. But I don't want to just be rich. I want to be wealthy. And what wealthy translates to me is how many years I don't have to worry about money. And the $250,000 doctor could be rich today but have no wealth built to their name. He or she could have no wealth built to their name. So where I talk to athletes is, hey, that play, that injury, that next contract, all that, that's in the future. Let's protect the future by protecting years of your lifestyle. And that's, again, why we come back to, all right, well, what does that lifestyle number look like for you today and moving forward? And if we can protect that lifestyle number, then I can confidently tell you as a 24-year-old, third year in a professional sport, I have 7 years of your lifestyle protected. You don't have to worry about money until you're 30 years old. That's wealth to me. And that's what the true dream of professional sports should be. But it's also the same dream of the $32,000 teacher. They have a different lifestyle spend, but as they begin to accrue enough and put their money to work for them, they can protect those same years and look at it that way instead of, hey, my investments made 12% this year. It's, I got one more year of my lifestyle protected and I'm 1 year wealthier.
Yeah, that's a really powerful way to think through these things, regardless of what your income level is. We're going to shift this. If you're willing to give me a couple more minutes to talk football, you okay with that?
Oh, always.
Okay. So have you reached out to Carl Nassib after his financial literacy was shown on Hard Knocks last year?
I made a little subtle send out to him, but no, I love what he did. His heart was in such a pure place. He's just very fortunate. He doesn't have a compliance department to have to report to. His methods were a little unsound. But I love that he stood up there and did that. I love that he's a curious young man. That was me. I just didn't have the courage to stand up and start to talk about it. I love that the locker room is starting to awaken around these subjects. I have also kind of become in contact with Brandon Copeland, who is another athlete who's very interested in these things. So what I'm looking at doing is continuing to educate teams as I'm being invited to more and more teams, but then to find these current players who are going to soon be former players that are also interested in it, give them the same challenge. Hey, brothers, you go get your CFP. If you are interested, become an expert in the field, and then we can go help a lot of people.
Yeah, that's a great point. Okay, you were a fullback. The fullback position is disappearing, especially with my Chicago Bears. I don't think they have one. They've kind of what position would you be playing if you were just coming out of college today? Would you be playing like a move tight end, inline blocker? What would you be doing?
So the fullback position has been dying for 20 years. It's never going to go anywhere. If you look continually at the playoffs and the final teams in the playoffs, typically three of the four final four have a fullback. When I was coming out of college, the same argument was being had is, Jed, at 6'1", you're the shortest tight end in college football. You don't have a chance to play in the NFL tight end, especially because you run a 5-flat. What are you going to do? And so they tagged me with this H-back. Again, I wasn't fast enough to be even that. So I was fullback by, you know, series of elimination, not by choice. And truly to understand why I became a good fullback was I had to humble myself and realize I had to be the best lead blocker, which was a skill set I had never even attempted. But I had to be the best lead blocker on the team and including anybody out the door waiting to take the opportunity from me. So I would see myself today if I was coming out of college as either unemployed or long snapper. Long snapping is another skill set I did pick up. And so I did that, you know, throughout my travels. I went to 12 different teams, but it was because nobody knew what I was going to be until I focused on my job number one. I love the fullback position because I feel like it's a keystone species. It keeps an element of the game that's a little bit what coaches would call me, which was, hey, you got to be a dirtbag. Offensive linemen got to be dirtbags. You got to be comfortable getting dirty and having that element of the game. When all of our offensive linemen go into 2-point stances, you eliminate the fullback position. Our D tackles to go from 340 down to 300. You're evolving the game, which is a positive because it's taking some of the violence out, but you're also losing a little bit of the mystique. So you're going to see the trend away from the fullback, and then somebody's going to come back and win a Super Bowl with one, i.e. the Patriots, and everybody's going to rush out and go get another fullback. But it is a funny day and age in the game that look at it and say, I was even telling a story to, a set of rookies this off season. And I was telling a story and I said, you know, I put my forehead into his chest and I knocked him on the ground. And one of the rookies raised his hand and said, oh, you led with your head. And I had to laugh. And I was like, Yeah, man, we were taught differently. Evolve with the game. The game is going in a good direction. But yeah, screws on his chest was a very easy coaching point for me as a fullback.
I could imagine. So give me your top three fullbacks of all time.
Oh, great question. Well, I grew up as a, you know, being a Bears fan, I grew up idolizing Brian Urlacher. I was a middle linebacker in high school, so go Bears there.
Yeah, I
got a quick
cup
of coffee and a sweatshirt with the Bears, which was fun. And got to play ping pong against Brian Urlacher in the locker room. And I held my own.
That's good. I heard he's an incredible ping pong player, by the way. This is not the first time I've had this come up.
He is an incredible competitor. So I think anything he wants to go get better at, he's going to go do that and do it well. My top three fullbacks, one of them I actually got to meet about a weekend or two ago over in Pullman, Washington, no place else. He played for the Seattle Seahawks for 14 years, Max Strong. His beautiful bride is now a professor at Washington State. I also, when I was playing, Lorenzo Neal
was phenomenal down for Chargers. He was on my list. So we're one for two right now. I'm curious to hear who your number three is here.
So Lorenzo Neal, Max Strong, and while I was playing, the guy who was holding the crown was Vontae Leach.
Oh,
and so I always watched him, and truly I learned how to play the position by watching him go and do it and seeing how he identified each rep as a personal challenge of proving his point and instilling his will. That was the mindset of a fullback, and that was something that I had to learn and eat and learn and eat. And then, of course, people always try to compare me to Mike Allscott. I was not him, but he was also a great fullback. He had a little bit more skill set than I did, so he got to do some more fun stuff.
He was a Boilermaker. He was from down the road. Yeah, Allscott was pretty awesome. Who's the best blocking tailback in the game right now? Who is the person who will step up in the pocket, even though that's not their primary responsibility, and deliver a blow?
Oh, great question. I honestly couldn't answer that right now. When I was playing, I was a guy named Karell Buckhalter who would lay the wood, played for a long time. Surprisingly, LaDainian Tomlinson, he wasn't always like a step up and punch you in the mouth, but that guy was a very efficient blocker. He understood angles and leverages and degrees. Wow, I'd have to think about who's the best pass blocker.
Get back to me on that one. We'll get that in an update episode. I mean, for me as a Chicago Bears fan, I like watching Walter Payton run, but watching him block also very, very incredible. It's something that I enjoy watching quite a bit. Okay, last one. Tell me who's in the Super Bowl this year and why.
Oh, great segue. So, you know, part of this is getting at what we're doing. So I'm currently writing an article that's going to come out here in a week or two around picking the Super Bowl winner as compared to picking your stock portfolio. A lot of similarities in the two. I love betting on greatness. It's very hard for me being repeatedly learned this lesson. You don't bet against the Patriots. And as long as they feel good, you know, Patrick Mahomes, the Chiefs are as stacked up as you can get. But the one thing they don't have is greatness yet. Yeah. And if you put dollar on dime, I'm going to go with the Patriots getting back one more time. And then I know he just signed an extension, but then Tom, just hang him up and walk away, man. Jeez.
Yeah. I think he wants to play till he's 55. I don't see that happening anytime soon. He'll be drawing Social Security and still probably flat.
And then on the other side, you know, one play away, got rebuilt, rebranded, and still they have greatness working for them. New Orleans changed my life. I'm a who dat. So I'd love to see Drew get one more opportunity and then him do the same thing. It's great to see a Tom and Drew final and then both of them ride off into the sunset, but that's never going to happen. If I was a betting man today, the Saints definitely feel like they got a lot of momentum, a lot of little spike behind them. And the Patriots, you can't bet against them.
Yeah, I can't take issue with that. One of my fellow administrators in my school is a massive Saints fan. So I'm sure when he listens to this, he's going to razz me quite a bit. What should I expect from my Bears? Are they going to take a step forward, or are they going to take a step back this year?
I hope so. Mainly because their general manager is a former New Orleans Saint.
That's right, Ryan Pace.
And he's been putting together a great program. You know, this is their time. If they're going to do it, they got a cheap quarterback. They got the best defense in the game. I unfortunately don't see them even really getting out of their division.
Oh, don't tell me you think the Packers are going to reclaim the NFC North throne this year.
I think, again, going back to that greatness piece, I think Aaron Rodgers can come back with enough of a chip, enough of getting told Patrick Mahomes and Tom Brady are the best in the game and come out with something to prove and prove it concisively. I also don't think Minnesota's out of the running. Minnesota's got a good squad.
Yeah, Kirk Cousins. What's he doing for you?
You're not a believer.
Yeah, no. I am definitely much more concerned about the Packers than I am about the Vikings. Although I like that Vikings defense. I mean the Packers' lifetime against the Bears since Favre, it's pretty remarkably terrible. So I'm definitely not going to count them out, but I do hope that, you know, Khalil Mack sits on top of him a couple times this first year on Thursday night. But we'll see. I'm going to the London game against the Raiders, so I'm looking forward to that because I haven't been able to see NFL football in person for quite some time now.
I love that. The London experience is a great time. I got to go when I was with Detroit over there. It was really neat to see Joe Montana jerseys and Ricky Waters and just old throwback jerseys from people over there. It was really cool to be like, man, these guys have either been fans for a long time or just went to a surplus store before they came. But it was a really cool environment and just neat to see the game continue to expand. That's the beautiful part about football today is, you know, who knows what this season's about to bring. I'm hoping, you know, that there's a couple rising stars that shine, and there's a couple teams we haven't spoken about. Obviously, being a Washington State grad, I know some Cougs out there that I'm wishing the best for, and so whenever they're playing, I root for them. So it's a beautiful time, and I got the text with a bunch of, you know, coaches and players while they were reporting for camp. Everybody asked me if I missed the game. There's very, very little about the game that I missed because of the violence. But the one thing I do miss is end of July reporting and knowing everybody who's walking in this building has one common purpose. And that is something that you lose and you can't find or mimic anywhere else. But it's truly special. Everybody has that emotional toll of, we know why we're here. Let's start going for it. It's a really neat feeling.
Yeah, it makes you think about organizational leadership and clarifying what the purpose is of what we're doing, too. That's a great point. Jed, I've taken a lot of your time. Where can people learn more about you if they want to? I mean, most of the audience are going to be educators, so if they're interested in learning about your book or some of the financial literacy things that you've created, how can they reach you?
Absolutely. So please connect with me on LinkedIn, Jedediah Collins. I've just joined Instagram because I had enough students telling me I was a fool for not being on Instagram. So Jed.Collins45 or Twitter, Jed.Collins45. What I'm really excited about, Teach Me Money, First 10 Questions of Your Financial Journey. We're looking at publishing in October or November. It's currently at the publisher and designer right now, so finishing touches there. That is level one in the beginning of what I hope is a series of curriculum that I've already been teaching and writing about, just haven't published yet. So I would love, especially for people that are sitting in your seats, who are educators, who are influencers and impactors in young people's lives, this is a passion of mine. The Teach Me Money series, its first goal is to open 1 million Roth IRA or 401k accounts. Why? Because if a young professional opens a Roth account, it's because they understand how to use money. They're strategizing how to use money, and they're being efficient in how they are using their money. So that's a really neat goal that we're setting for ourselves. If we get there, who knows? If we get there in 10 years, all the better. But I am a big believer and a lifelong learner. I love getting connected with you, Jeremy, and learning more about what you're doing and how you're doing it. And so I welcome any feedback, thoughts, tips, and then as the book comes out, absolutely anything in regards to that.
Yeah, we'll have you back on when the book's ready to release and you can talk about it in more detail. Jed, I really appreciate your time. I know you're a really busy guy, and I know it's probably super early in the morning right now for you, but you are officially dismissed.